23-2395, Bravieri v. Chandler. Mr. Jensen.
Good morning, Your Honors. Just give me one second. What's the time I could stand behind this? Your Honors, this...
You can lower it if you want. Do you want to lower the podium?
No, this is fine, thank you. Your Honors, on May 5th, May 5th, 2006, Judge Manning issued a certificate of appealability as to a single issue relating to a petition for habeas corpus that she had denied. The issue was Mr. Bravieri denied the right to constitutionally effective counsel when his lawyer agreed to a partial defense with counsel for Bravieri's co-defendant, who failed to obtain the promised forensic analysis of the fingerprint on the gun used to shoot one of two victims that he had been convicted of, Joanne Gassick. Now, Your Honors, the response of the state is, first of all, that the petition was not timely filed. The background is essentially that on April, the conviction was finalized in July of 95. On April 24th, 1996, the statute was passed, which gave the petitions a one year to file the petition. The habeas was filed prior to the 1 year on April 22nd, 1997. The post-conviction in the state court was filed in 98. We had filed the habeas in state court and in federal court, and what had occurred was that new issues had come up, and we asked the permission, and we did go into state court in order to exhaust remedies. The judge, when informed of this, basically suggested to us that we file a motion dismissing the petition and asking, and with the condition that it would be 30 days. We would have 30 days in order to reinstate. The purpose of it, of course, was so that we could exhaust our state remedy. We followed the judge's suggestion. We filed a motion to that effect. But I think it's important to note that the order entered by Judge Manning was not a dismissal giving us 30 days, but was, in fact, a dismissal, and, in fact, with leave to reinstate. The 30 days that was suggested in the order, the 30 days that was suggested in my motion, was not entered into the final order. And so we would suggest to this court that the order that was entered by Judge Manning is the order that we are bound by. Now, alternatively, we would suggest to the court that the 30 days that we are talking about, that this 30 days that was in the suggested order of Judge Manning was, in fact, not a deadline, but nothing more than a case management date, 30 days. Now, what occurred, and why this is relevant, is another lawyer took over the appeal. The appeal was decided, and, in fact, the finalization was sometime in October of 2005, I believe, Your Honor. And what had occurred in this particular case was that because of the fact that the trial lawyer or the trial, the one who filed the trial subpoena or the trial, I'm sorry, Judge, I'm a little nervous. 40 years and I still get nervous when I come in front of Your Honors. That in October, when we filed it, the lawyer, myself, was incapacitated. And we had filed a motion, basically, later on, was incapacitated. I had a series of four surgeries, new knee, new hip, spinal fusion that didn't work, prostate, and as a result, we didn't file it within the 30 days. As soon as we became aware of it, we did file a motion in front of Judge Manning to reinstate. She allowed the reinstatement. The state came in front of Judge Manning on a motion to reconsider the reinstatement, allegedly saying that we had violated the 30-day limitation. Judge denied it. Judge granted the reinstatement on the basis of the fact that she perceived her motion, her order to be interlocutory, and in fact it was at the time because the 30-day limitation wasn't in it. She said that under Newell, which was decided after after her order giving us, suggesting the dismissal, that that should have been a stay. And then she goes on to say that notwithstanding what occurred here, that that under 60B6, she had a right to reinstate it. And so it was reinstated. We argued we briefed the petition. The petition was denied. On the briefs, the government made that same allegation regarding the timeliness. They make it here today. And basically, what we're arguing with regard to that particular motion, that Judge Manning was correct. Judge Manning stated that she believed the order was interlocutory, and did not in either of her rulings, the motion to reinstate and the motion regarding in the opinion itself, never once said that the 30 days was considered by her as a deadline. And I think that's very, very telling in this case. So as a result, based on her view that it was interlocutory, based on her view of 60B6, and of course the state raises 60B1 also, we point out it was filed within a year. We point out that it was filed with a petition suggesting why the delay was made, and we would suggest to Your Honor that the petition wasn't untimely. Now, as to the merits of the petition, it's a simple argument, and it's been argued in front of the appellate court of Illinois, and it's been argued in front of Judge Manning's. It's a simple argument. In this case, Breveri's attorney, a not that experienced attorney, and the co-defendant's lawyer joined forces without Breveri's knowledge or consent, whereby they would share certain responsibilities regarding a fingerprint. The fingerprint was never tested, as that lawyer had promised. The forensic expert was never cross-examined by that lawyer. That lawyer, it is uncontradicted, was mentally impaired before, during, and after the trial. And the fact of the matter is, this was done without the knowledge of Breveri. Now, the argument that we've made, and we made it in front of the judge here, the argument that was made in front of Judge Manning was simply that that fingerprint, had it been tested, could have at least corroborated Mr. Breveri's story in this case. It was ultimately agreed. And it was ultimately stated by Judge Manning in this case that because of the credibility questions that she, the credibility findings that she made as to the witnesses, that in fact it wouldn't have made any difference. And so the second prong of Strickland was not followed. I would suggest that assessing the credibility of a witness, when the only thing the finder of fact did was say guilty or not guilty, was not the proper test. The fact of the matter is, it was corroborated, if Breveri's statement was corroborated by virtue of the fingerprint not being his, notwithstanding the arguments that are made by the state, and notwithstanding the argument in the appellate court, there is a reasonable probability that there could have been a reversal in this case. And the reasonable probability is the integrity of the verdict. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. We'll hear now from Ms. Myers.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Leah Myers from the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of Respondent Warden Nedra Chandler. This court should affirm the denial of habeas relief by the district court either because the petition is untimely or because the state appellate court reasonably applied Strickland in rejecting the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Opposing counsel provided a summary of what happened and procedurally as to the petition's timeliness. And while his summary was correct, we would take issue with his argument that there was no 30-day deadline put on the reinstatement. His motion for reinstatement specifically requested leave to refile within 30 days, and that was the motion that was granted. And up until this point at oral argument, all parties have proceeded as if that deadline was in place. Because the petition was originally filed only 3 days short of the one-year statute of limitations, the 30-day reinstatement deadline was extending, in effect, the time in which he could get habeas relief. Upon the expiration of the 30-day deadline, he was therefore automatically time-barred as to refiling his petition. And at that point, this case was indistinguishable from this court's recent case of Dulles versus Chambers. In Dulles, this court noted that as soon as a habeas petitioner is barred from refiling a petition due to untimeliness, a dismissal order at that point is not interlocutory, but it becomes a final judgment that cannot be reconsidered by the district court.
Did the district court have extended the time before the time ran?
That's true. If he had filed a motion for extension of time within the 30 days, sure, the district court could have extended at that point, but he did not file anything within that 30-day period. The fact that he's trying to argue for an...
What if it didn't have any 30-day limit? What would have been the effect?
Well, this court should not... the effect in that instance was that it would have been timely. However, it is inappropriate for the district court to give no limit in that way because the one-year statute of limitations would therefore have no effect. And because the motion for reinstatement was over 7 months beyond the 30 days, that was in effect would affect double the one-year statute of limitations, which is strictly enforced. Furthermore, the district court
but
cited...
But the 30-day limitation... If she had done that, and in fact said not within 30 days, but just with leave to reinstate, you're arguing that that would, first of all, extend it and render null and void the statute of limitations, right?
That's true. That's true. And furthermore, that was not argued in the brief. This argument by opposing counsel is raised for the first time here before the court now.
Except that we're talking about a time bar. It's not time-barred as a matter of law, but it's time-barred as a discretionary act by the district court.
That's true, because a 30-day deadline, assuming it existed, already extended the one-year statute of limitations. And the second basis that the district court used to try to justify its reinstatement beyond the 30 days was Rule 60b-6, and there are two reasons that that should not apply. The first is that, as this court said in Arrieta, the applicable provision should have been B1, which allows for reconsideration of an order due to mistake. And in Arrieta, the mistake was that the habeas petitioner had sought dismissal rather than a stay, which is the same situation here. Under B1, there is a one-year limitation to reconsideration of the order. And under B6, the catch-all provision, there is no one-year deadline. That is why in Arrieta, this court explained that B6 should not be used in cases of mistake, because that would be a way of dodging the one-year limitation under B1. And secondly, the 60B6 also should not apply under the standards applicable there. 60B6 only applies if there are extraordinary circumstances. And here, the only allegations are that petitioner was unaware of when state court proceedings ended because he was not state court counsel, but he could have kept in contact with state court counsel or contacted the state court directly. His second explanation is that because 6 years had passed, he forgot about the 30-day deadline and he had trouble finding the case file. This, too, should not be extraordinary circumstances because, as this court said in the Popovich case in our brief, that an attorney carelessness does not constitute extraordinary circumstances. His final reason, which he mentioned here today as well, is that he underwent spinal surgery and rehabilitation. But because he is a member of a law firm and was not incapacitated, certainly there are other attorneys in his firm who should have been and could have monitored his caseload. Or, as Your Honor referenced, he could have filed a motion for extension of the 30-day period within that period and cited his medical difficulties. Because the order, the 1998 dismissal order, was a final judgment under Dulles, and because Rule 60B did not justify revisitation of it by the district court, this court should reverse the conclusion that the petition was timely. But even if this court were to reach the merits of the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, it too fails, because the state court reasonably applied Strickland in finding that there was no prejudice. The specific claim we have here is that petitioner's counsel made an agreement with co-defendant's counsel that attorney would secure forensic fingerprint testing of the shotgun used to kill Joanne Gasek, and neither attorney in the end secured this testing. Petitioner's defense at trial was that, rather than him, it was Carmine Sarlo who had killed Joanne Gasek, and that he subsequently killed Sarlo in self-defense. His argument is, if the fingerprint had belonged to Sarlo, that would have bolstered his self-defense claim. However, the state appellate court noted that even if the fingerprint had belonged to Sarlo, it would be entirely consistent with the state's theory of the case and would not support a self-defense claim given the evidence presented at trial, and this was entirely reasonable. First of all, there was the testimony of eyewitness Sandra Ault, who noted that after Gasek was killed, there was a struggle between Sarlo and Petitioner, and perhaps also the co-defendant Zuniga, over the shotgun. And in fact, Petitioner himself testified at trial similarly that after Gasek was shot, there was a struggle between himself and Sarlo over the shotgun to the point that Sarlo got possession of the shotgun, hit him with the shotgun, drawing blood. If in the course of this struggle, Sarlo could have left a fingerprint on the shotgun, and so the identity of whose fingerprint was on the shotgun would not necessarily show who was the murderer of Joanne Gasek prior to that struggle. And secondly, there was certainly compelling evidence of Petitioner's guilt. All testified that she observed Petitioner from a close vantage point, knowing Petitioner, run into the other room, stand over the couch on which Gasek lay sleeping, point the shotgun downward and say, "You gotta go, Joanne, you just gotta go," before two shots were fired. And in fact, Gasek was killed by a double shotgun wounds. Secondly, then Petitioner ran back into the room, shot at her, and she fell down as if dead, trying to protect herself, although he had missed. And then Petitioner went on to the kitchen where he struggled with Sarlo and Zuniga over the shotgun. At that point, Ault could no longer see the struggle, but she heard Petitioner say, "You gotta go too, Carmi, you just gotta go," which refers to Carmine Sarlo. And she also heard Petitioner say, "Shoot him in the head, Ricky," which is referring to co-defendant Richard Zuniga. She also heard a rustling in the silverware drawer, which is consistent with the fact that Sarlo received several stab wounds. And this is compelling evidence of his guilt, especially in light of the fact that there was an implausibility about his self-defense claim. Specifically, what he described happened is that Petitioner and his co-defendant had to kill Sarlo in self-defense, so it was a two-on-one confrontation. At that point, according to the coroner, Sarlo suffered over 20 stab wounds, over 20 wounds due to blunt force trauma, and 4 gunshot wounds. It is implausible that two men would have to inflict 50 wounds on a single man just in self-defense. Instead, that is much more consistent with intentional murder for which they both were convicted. In light of all this evidence presented at trial, the outcome of any fingerprint testing was not, there was no reasonable probability that that would have any impact on the outcome of the proceedings. And that is why the state court, in acknowledging this evidence, reasonably applied Strickland in so concluding. Briefly, I should address the fact that Petitioner before this court tries to argue that prejudice should be presumed due to a conflict of interest. This argument should be forfeited because it was never raised in state court nor in the district court. But even if this court were to consider it on the merits, it too fails. Because under Kyler versus Sullivan, prejudice should be presumed only if two factors are met, that there is an actual conflict of interest, and second, that it has an adverse effect on representation. Here, all that is alleged is that there was an agreement pre-trial for things to be done, which in the end were not completed. And there is case law, such as Berger, cited in our brief, where there is much more extensive actions taken by counsel on behalf of two co-defendants, which was not found to be an actual conflict of interest by the United States Supreme Court. And as earlier discussed, because the fingerprint had little import in the case, there was no adverse effect on the representation. Because of the fact that prejudice cannot be established and it should not be presumed, this court should affirm the district court's conclusion that the state court reasonably applied Strickland in rejecting the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, or respondent respectfully requests that this court affirm on the basis of untimeliness. And if there are no further questions, I will end there. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Myers. Mr. Jensen has how much time? You have 1 minute, sir.
That's all I was going to take. Thank you. I wanted to make this point to Your Honor. The order that was entered by Judge Manning was petitioner's motion for voluntary dismissal without prejudice is granted and so ordered. The 30 days that we're talking about was not included in the order. The court also ruled in terms of B6, and we would suggest to Your Honor that she had ample reason to do it. If that 30 days was something that was relevant, if that 30 days was a deadline, it would have been mentioned in either of Judge Manning's opinion. It wasn't. It mentioned that it exists. We suggest it wasn't a deadline. We suggest that it was that if there was a stay, we would suggest finally that with regard to the issues as to B1 and B6, we had a perfect right and she had a perfect right to grant the motion. As to the issue relative to the, it is true, as the state says, that the conflict of interest was never raised, that until or in about the brief that was filed, that was not raised in state court or by the original habeas corpus petition, that I would suggest that what this judge did or what this lawyer did in not allowing a man who was mentally unstable, was mentally ill, to run his case was incompetent. And I would lastly suggest that with regard to the issue of whether there was error, the issue as to credibility was an issue that was contested at trial. If this would have been there to corroborate Mr. Breveri, we might have been able, or the trial lawyer would have been able, or perhaps able, to get a not guilty as to one of those murders. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. Thank you to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.